Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. We're getting close to having to make some decisions in this country about the direction that we're going to go. Of course, the midterm elections are coming up here in Washington State. Ballots just started arriving in the mail for the primary election, which is happening on August 2nd. I was writing, we do a Undivided newsletter every Sunday that comes out on Patreon and Locals, and I was writing about how voting is like a process in our household. I live with my boyfriend, and we cooked some steaks on the Traeger. We smoked some steaks. We made some whiskey drinks, and we sat down and decided on who we were planning to vote for in the midterms. And we tried to come to a consensus as a household because we know there's a possibility, and sometimes they do, that our votes will cancel each other out. That's happened in previous presidential elections. And so where we can, we try to come to an agreement on who to vote for. And I will say that our ballots are 100% in line. We did have to talk through a couple things. There's, of course, a U.S. Senate race on ballots in Washington State and congressional races as well. We happen to live in what I believe is one of the most fascinating congressional districts in the entire country. We live in the 8th congressional district in Washington, which is a swing seat. It was long held by Republicans. It's been held by Democratic Congresswoman Kim Schreier for two terms. And this is really thought to be kind of a bellwether for whether Democrats can hold on to swing seats, whether this midterm is going to be as bad for Democrats as some political pundits believe it's going to be. And there are a couple really strong Republican candidates going up this time around. By the way, I'm going to have sit downs with them on Wednesday's show. So stay tuned for that. We're going to talk about all sorts of relevant issues. More on that in a moment. But I was really excited to be able to vote in the 8th congressional district. Of course, I'm not going to tell you who we voted for as a household, but it doesn't. It's not going to influence my reporting on this election and on this issue. And so we really make kind of a day out of voting, and I hope you do too. It's incredibly important to get your ballots in. I had heard from one person that they thought that primaries were only for people who identify with one of the political parties. That is not the case. What you're thinking about is a presidential primary where it is a party nominating process. That's not this. Anyone can and should vote in the August 2nd primary in Washington State and in primaries across the country. I also just want to take a moment before we dive into some of the issues at stake in this election to really congratulate every single political candidate who is running. You know, when I drive in to the studio every morning and I see all the political signs for local offices and national offices that line the streets, I just think, first of all of you are crazy. I think it takes a crazy person to run for politics in today's climate. Look, it's brutal out there. I mean, you open yourself up to so much criticism online, in the media, your entire life sometimes picked apart. I know how much work, I mean, I don't know personally, but in speaking to political candidates, how much work goes into it, knocking on doors, just trying to earn votes. And so I think that any person in today's climate, whether you're running for the smallest local office or U.S. Senate, you absolutely deserve a pat on the back for being willing to step up and want to serve your communities and want to serve your country. It's a very rare desire to want to have, and especially in today's not only political climate, how divisive things are, but how serious things are. We're talking about a time of real struggle for a lot of Americans with the cost of gas, with the economy and inflation. And so you're stepping up and saying, hey, I want to be part of that solution. And I think that's a really, really noble thing. So even if there's politicians who I'm a little hard on sometimes, I admire your desire and your willingness to serve your fellow citizens. And so I think that's a really big deal. I did put out a subscriber poll today. Because as I was filling out my ballot, I kind of thought, I know what I prioritize. I mean, I always go and, you know, look specifically at the candidate's personal priorities and political platform. I am not a party line voter. I go back and forth often. I really am voting for the person, not the party. And I was curious what you guys prioritize when you fill out your ballots. Because inevitably, there's going to be candidates in races who you've never heard of, who you know nothing about? And so I put out a poll for subscribers. I hope you guys have taken it. And I want to read some of the comments. So the question is, as the primary election nears, which of these things would most influence what candidates get your vote? And the options were political party, relevant experience, a familiar name, endorsements, or the candidate's personal platform. And you might think familiar name is silly to include, but there are some people who are like, hey, I know who that person is. I'm going to vote for that person. So sometimes name recognition does come into play. I want to read a couple of responses. Dale said, I checked political party because the party controls the person. So even if I think the candidate may be a person of integrity, the party will control their votes regardless. Thus, where the party stands on issues is more important than the individual's positions during the election cycle. Anthony Tackett, hi Anthony, said, I hate that this is true, but it is, responding to Dale. Larry said, endorsements don't help to get my vote. On the contrary, I can frequently rule out a candidate based on who endorses them. Larry, that's so true. For instance, The Stranger in Seattle, the All Weekly, anyone The Stranger endorses, I know that that's just going to be the candidate for me. So that is so true. Lene said, I consider each of the above and even ruled one candidate out due to their personal platform being written in the third party or in the third person, maybe. But I do tend to agree with Dale's comment. Let's see. Bobby said, the Dems are nuts. I wish the personal platform ran the candidate, but the party does. Let's fit one more in here. Kirk says, for me, it's a mix of answers. In general, I won't vote for Democrats at all. Republicans, slightly less so. Mega Republicans are out entirely. So anyway, this poll is going to be up for a couple days. So please go to Patreon or Locals and take that poll because I want to hear your thoughts and I'll read some more of your comments throughout the week. We've been talking a lot on the show about what issues voters are going to prioritize this time around. I tend to think that I just thought, you know, and we've talked about this, there's no way the economy can't be number one. The economy is something that impacts every single person, regardless of gender, regardless of race, regardless of socioeconomic status. When we talk about, you know, whether it's your stocks, whether it's the price of your home, trying to buy a new home, the price at the pump, the price at the grocery store. I mean, it is impacting every single person every single day. And so to me, I just think, well, gosh, the economy has to be number one. Well, apparently not for everyone. So I don't know if you guys have been paying attention. In Washington State, there was this big poll put out that was done by a variety of publications. So it was in coordination with King TV in Seattle, the NBC affiliate, the Seattle Times, the UW Center for an Informed Public, and WSU's Murrow College of Communication. And they polled 825 Washington State adults, including, I want to say some of them were, they had a breakdown of registered voters. Let me just make sure I get this right. So this was conducted online July 6th through July 10th by SurveyUSA. It was the poll was taken by 825 adults, including 731 registered voters and 596 likely voters. It also said the respondents were weighted to the U.S. Census proportions for gender, age, race, education, and home ownership. So that's a little bit about the poll. And I'll give the caveat that I'm not sure I 100% ever really buy into polls. 825 is a very small segment of the population in Washington State. However, there aren't a lot of local polls that are done. There's national polling, but local polling is always going to be fascinating to me. But there were some results that I found quite interesting. We talked about the 8th Congressional District, how it is a bellwether for what's going to happen in the country. It's also a mostly suburban district. The 8th Congressional District is to the east of Seattle, so it includes some of the suburbs of Seattle, but it also spans across the mountain passes and into areas that are more, you know, farming and rural. So in that sense, it's a really fascinating district. But one of the things I saw in this, so these news agencies have been just leaking out little bits and pieces of the poll. Like, I just want to see the whole thing. But of course, they want to get their clicks in the days and weeks leading up to the election. So they're doing like one issue, you know, guns and one race or whatever. They did approval ratings for Joe Biden and Governor Jay Inslee. Buried in one of the articles, the many articles that the Seattle Times has put out on this issue, It says, and I'll read the line, when asked to pick the issue most important to them in the recent WA poll commissioned by the Seattle Times and Partners, abortion was number one among suburban Washington voters, and inflation was number two. I have a really hard time believing that. I mean, I really have a hard time believing that. Now, look, I'm not doubting that abortion is a huge issue. We've talked about this, particularly for suburban women. But inflation is something that impacts everyone. Washington State, abortion is legal up to the point of fetal viability. And so that's not going to change here, at least that I know of in the short term or long term. And so it's interesting that you would have suburban voters who took part in this poll say that's the number one issue, despite the fact it's not going to impact their everyday lives. So I've been asking some Seattle Times journalists to provide the data on this, because while they've been putting out little, like I said, bits and pieces of this poll, they haven't put out the questions specifically pertaining to that, specifically pertaining to what issue is most important to voters in this upcoming election. And so I just want to see that actual data and the breakdown of the data. Now, they did put out a couple questions that they asked specific to abortion. One of them was, do you support or oppose the Supreme Court's recent decision overturning Roe v. Wade? 63% of people who took that poll said that they opposed, in Washington State, the Supreme Court decision. That's a pretty big number, not necessarily surprising in a blue state like Washington, where you have a lot of moderate Republicans who would probably oppose that decision as well. For instance, 79% of Democratic voters strongly opposed it, but 21% of Republicans strongly opposed it as well, and 46% of independents strongly opposed the Supreme Court ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade. And I think that's key. I've always said that independents make or break elections, and you see that here, 46% of independents saying they strongly oppose the decision on Roe v. Wade. There was a second question they released about abortion saying, do you support or oppose efforts by Washington state leaders to help people in other states get abortions in Washington? 50% of Republicans strongly oppose that, but 66% of Democrats strongly support that, and 36% of independents strongly support Washington state leaders helping people in other states get abortions in Washington. So I thought that was interesting. So here are two questions released in this poll that show that at least the people, 825 adults who were polled, have a not so great reaction to what happened with the Supreme Court ruling around abortion. But I still want to see the breakdown of data that tells us that suburban voters are going to prioritize abortion in Washington State ahead of inflation and the economy. I also do wonder whether the line of questioning made any differential between people who that's their number one issue because they oppose abortion, or that's their number one issue because they support abortion access. And so I just need to see the data before I really take that line at face value. So anyway, continue to take this poll on our on my Patreon and Locals pages to tell me what influences your vote when you go to fill out your ballots. And I'll be reading some of the comments from you guys throughout the week. But no matter what influences your vote, no matter who you're going to vote for, what party they might belong to, I just really strongly encourage you to get those ballots in. You know, I've heard from some Republicans, I saw a comment on my Facebook, well, will our votes count this time around? The only way you can absolutely guarantee that your vote is not going to count is if you don't fill out your ballot and you don't turn it in. So please do so. Another reason I really want to see the results of the specific poll question on what issue is most important to voters heading into the midterms is because I wanted to see where crime and public safety fell on that list. I'm assuming it was one of the options. You have seen, I think, some Democrats slowly start to realize that public safety is, one, a problem, a very real problem, and two, it is something that suburban voters are, in particular, are really concerned about. For example, Congresswoman Kim Schreier, who currently serves the 8th Congressional District in Washington, she put out a campaign ad about public safety. And that to me was really one of the first times that I saw her prioritizing that issue. Now, I would also argue that the national media has ignored the public safety crisis in this country in favor of other things. I'm not going to lump everyone into that box, but I think when you talk about the networks, for instance, they really have ignored the public safety crisis, particularly in some liberal and progressive cities. I think local news does a better job. For instance, my former station, Fox 13 in Seattle, they've always prioritized safety as a pillar of coverage. They had Washington's Most Wanted with David Rose, and I thought they always did a really good job of prioritizing public safety in their news coverage. But the network news, it's been almost non-existent. Take a real good look at what is happening in some of these major cities and where are politicians falling short. It's why I was really surprised to see this story from NBC News. NBC News, and Brian Stelter pointed this out. He tweeted, NBC called it One Night in America. Four correspondents spent Saturday night in four cities to examine America's gun violence epidemic. The resulting report took up 13 minutes of Sunday's weekend nightly news, a broadcast that's 21 minutes without ads. So NBC sent four correspondents across the country to look at the issue of shootings in these four cities. And then they dedicated a huge chunk of airtime to it.
We're going to begin by focusing on the overwhelming amount of gun violence happening every single day in America. More than 40,000 people are killed each year by guns. And while we tend to focus on mass shootings, far more Americans are killed in smaller incidents. So tonight, we're going to chronicle gun violence across one night in America, specifically last night in America. We had teams embedded in communities across the country. Overnight, Gabe Gutierrez was inside R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore, the first facility in the world dedicated to treating trauma. Gotti Schwartz was with the Houston Police Department riding along to different shooting scenes overnight. I spent the night in Chicago with street pastor Donovan Price. He spends his nights rushing to incidents and hospitals to help the families of those lost. And Jesse Kirsch was with the Philadelphia Police Department. Their shift started with a mass shooting.
Now, a couple thoughts about this. There is a segment, I'm mostly among the right, who's been pointing out the problem with shootings, you know, on a local level. You know, the media has this intense obsession with mass shootings, and I don't blame them. I mean, mass shootings need to be covered, of course. They're horrific. But you always see, and I think mostly on the right, then bring up, what about the nightly shootings in Chicago? Why aren't you paying any attention to that? And some people dismiss that as racist or not as big of a deal. And now you've got NBC who's like, oh, we're going to do this, you know, special report on all these shootings happening across the country. Like, welcome, NBC. Welcome to the struggle. But you'll also notice that NBC paints this as a gun violence issue. And so it's clearly suiting a particular political agenda to look at it as, let's look at America's gun violence epidemic, as opposed to paying attention to the public safety crisis, what be it guns or other robberies or burglaries that's happening across America. And so, yes, you have finally the network news paying attention to the public safety crisis in this country, but they're doing it in a way that furthers their agenda of, you know, getting rid of guns or promoting guns as the key problem, not people as the key problem. Ever since we launched Undivided, we've been talking about the issue of vaccine mandates and specifically the impact that they're having on public safety. We know that there are police officers, there are firefighters and first responders who were fired for refusing to get the COVID vaccine. If you've been following Undivided, we've specifically been focusing on Eastside Fire and Rescue, which is a fire agency in a suburb of Seattle that terminated firefighters for refusal to get the vaccine, did not accommodate their religious exemptions. And now the group of fired firefighters have filed claims totaling $170 million. So they're looking for $170 million in damages from their former agency. The claim is a precursor to a lawsuit. I spoke with one of the firefighters who is part of that effort. Introduce yourself, sir.
I'm Rocky Martinez.
And what is your former job title with Eastside Fire and Rescue?
I was a lieutenant and the hazmat team leader for Eastside Fire and Rescue.
Tell me a little bit about your career as a firefighter.
I spent 18 years with Eastside, 3 years as a volunteer prior to being hired. I was hired in July of 2003, right after returning from Iraq, my first deployment with the U.S. Marine Corps. And then I deployed again in 2005 for my second deployment, and pretty much been at Eastside ever since.
So you've been in some capacity serving your community and your country since you were an adult.
Correct. I knew when I was a sophomore in high school that I was going to devote my life to public service.
Why Eastside Fire and Rescue? For people, I know there are people who don't live in the Seattle area who watch this. Eastside Fire and Rescue essentially serves a suburb of Seattle.
Correct. It's about 220 square miles east of King County, or in East King County, serving the cities of Issaquah, Sammamish, North Bend, and then Fire District 10 and 38, which are kind of the unincorporated areas around those cities. Eastside, why I wanted Eastside was because I actually grew up in Sammamish before it became a city. I graduated from Issaquah High School, went to Pine Lake Middle, even Sunny Hills Elementary for fifth grade. And so I wanted to give back to the same community that gave to me while I was growing up. So that's why Eastside was my dream agency. And when I got hired, it was like, perfect. This is the perfect scenario. So.
Yeah, and you were able to give back to that community for a long time. It's a difficult question, but what are some of the most memorable, probably in a bad way, I imagine, maybe in a good way, memorable calls that you went on in that community?
There's quite a few. I mean, some too many to count. I think, you know, one of the ones that kind of showed the how small the community and how tight-knit the community, even though the patients involved were not members of the community, unfortunately, it led to a fatality. It was a car accident on I-90, and seeing how small that, you know, that 7 degrees of separation, the patient was related to my mother in a small way. My mother actually knew their landlord. So it was kind of weird, but also good that because the remaining family members were taken care of very quickly due to the incident. And, you know, unfortunately, like I said, it wasn't a fatality, but it was nice to be able to kind of vent with the stress of that call and making sure, seeing the end result, that that family was still taken care of.
You mentioned that you were hazmat team lead. Is that a really specialized position?
It is. It takes additional training. You have to be a hazardous materials technician in order to be the team leader. Also, you have to go through, you know, further advanced training. So like incident command systems, hazmat incident command specific to hazardous materials calls. Usually it's a senior team member who has gone through more extensive training than just a technician. I actually was kind of the assistant zone coordinator. So zone one pretty much covers East King County, kind of like Mercer Island East. So our hazmat team is involved in the zone one consortium, which covers Bellevue, Redmond, Kirkland, kind of that whole East King County. So I assisted with the zone team as well, where, you know, we got together as a zone to train and make sure our team was up to date with all their training and current technologies.
Without, you know, let's pretend the pandemic never happened and we would have all, you know, continued on our lives as normal. What were your career plans?
Was to stay with Eastside Fire and retire, you know, stay there as long as I could, you know, hopefully promote throughout the ranks and eventually be a battalion chief. That was the plan. Continue serving the community till, you know, it was time for me to call it quits.
So tell me how that plan was derailed.
Well, in August of 2021, the governor issued a mandate for all healthcare workers in Washington State to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Approximately September 20th, our Fire Chief Jeff Clark, made a statement throughout Eastside Fire and Rescue that there will be no accommodations for those involved in patient healthcare. So those individuals who submitted for a religious exemption or a medical exemption, we're not going to be accommodated based off his statement. Almost, I believe everyone who submitted for a religious exemption was approved. So their exemption was approved. But prior to even Chief Clark meeting with those individuals who had the approved exemptions, he unilaterally stated that there would be no accommodations involved in patient healthcare.
And that kind of stems from a Governor Inslee mandate, which is if you're working with patients. And so I think there are some ways Eastside Fire and Rescue's hands were tied and some ways that their hands were certainly not tied that they blamed on the governor for a little coverage. But just, you know, at the base level, why did you not want the vaccine?
For religious reasons. I have been through very numerous things where my faith has really been challenged. Also my deployment to Iraq, my faith has gotten stronger as I've aged. It was the calling from God that this was not right for me. I do also have a medical condition that I was not comfortable getting it, and I don't want to discuss my medical condition publicly, obviously. But it was submitting that religious exemption and like, okay, hey, maybe there's an opportunity. Again, I would be more than willing to do any accommodation that we can come to agreement with, but there was no attempt at an accommodation.
I've got to play devil's advocate. As you said, you're a Marine. I have a lot of friends in the military who had all number of vaccines stuck in their arm and basically had no choice. So I guess why now would getting a vaccine or having the government mandate a vaccine bother you when you went through it in the military?
Because I was mandated before, in my experience with the anthrax vaccine, that was mandatory when I was in. And partway through, I didn't have a choice. Yes, I was technically government property. When I signed that dotted line, I belong to the federal government. And, I don't have a choice. I can look at what my health decisions are and make those decisions what's best for me. And unfortunately, the vaccines were not best for me.
And does that apply to any vaccine or just the COVID vaccine?
I will admit, I have not taken a flu vaccine in probably about 10 years now. Those vaccines are right for me.
Now, and I've been very clear about my opinion about the vaccine mandate. I'm not in support of it. I did get the vaccine, haven't gotten any boosters, but Would it have changed your opinion of things, your approach to things, if the vaccine had been more successful in preventing transmission?
Well, I want to make sure that the 10 of us involved, are not anti-vaccine in any way, shape, or form. We are anti-mandate. Your situation is different from mine and it's different from theirs. And, every single one of us should be able to make that decision what's best for our situation. We worked the entirety of the pandemic prior to the vaccines coming. And, some of us received COVID during that. I personally did not. I actually worked the entirety of the pandemic on an aid unit. In fact, even worked on the agency's sole COVID positive transport vehicle, helped set it up. And I still didn't get COVID-19 because the PPE works when worn properly. It wasn't until I was put on unpaid leave that I actually contracted COVID. And I actually took two different antibody tests to confirm, was I one of those asymptomatic individuals that contracted it and had no idea? And both antibody tests said negative, that I did not have any antibodies against it. So the PPE worked.
Just to be clear, is your objection more philosophical or is there a specific religious reason why you don't want to get the vaccine?
Like I've stated prior, in any significant situation that's going to be life altering, I've always looked to God, prayed to God, and God responded back with a gut feeling, do not get this, why can I violate that? There's multiple times where I've gone back. It's like, hey, hearing from friends and family, the easiest thing to do is just get the vaccine. Absolutely. But I can't violate that now. God is continually telling me, do not get it.
Rocky, when was your separation date with Eastside Fire and Rescue?
My official, I was placed on unpaid leave on December 13th of 2021. And then I was separated from the agency officially, or terminated, non-disciplinary separation, on April 18th of 2022.
From when the vaccine mandate came down in October to April, was there any point where you were hopeful that you'd be able to keep your job?
Yes. We on April 4th, we had to notify the agency if we had an intent to get vaccinated and return. It was kind of a 2-week notice that yes, we were going to come back, or no, we weren't. We requested from the agency if we could have a review of our accommodations based off the information that changed over that time period, you know, the data that had come out, and there was no response from the agency.
Who at the end of the day are you angry with? That's a weird question, but is it the governor? Is it your agency? Who do you blame, I guess, for you not being a firefighter at the agency you wanted to retire with?
I will change the term from angry to frustrated, okay? The mandate allows for exemptions and accommodations. And as we've seen over the past couple months, even the governor clearly stated that, you know, it's the employer who has that legal right to approve or deny an exemption and approve or deny an accommodation. Part of that in the mandate is also the law, the Title VII law, that they have to prove undue hardship. And there has been no discussion of that. It's just, we can't do it because Dr. Ray made a recommendation. You know, Dr. Ray even responded that ultimately staffing decisions are made by the individual fire agencies. So, you know, it's the frustration is the finger pointing. You know, ultimately it lies with Fire Chief Jeff Clark. He is the one that makes that determination of, is he going to keep this staff through an accommodation process or is he not? And he has made the decision he will not.
And I don't want to assume that everyone listening has followed our coverage of this. So who is Dr. Ray?
Dr. Ray is the King County Medical Program Director. So he actually oversees all the EMTs and the paramedics that are within King County.
And for people who aren't familiar, we've covered this before. He actually did a study, I believe it was in coordination with the University of Washington, that found that first responders like yourself during the pandemic had an incredibly high success rate of not transmitting the virus using your PPE. So in that sense, he has kind of a history of contradicting himself in this regard. Where are you right now, Rocky?
I'm in Fort Worth, Texas.
Why are you in Fort Worth, Texas?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to become a firefighter in other agencies within Washington State. And, you know, so because of that, I had to seek employment elsewhere. And, you know, for what me and my family have endured over these last, you know, now what, 9 months, 8 months, it was time for us to go somewhere else.
Now, have you officially moved?
We have officially moved. Currently, we're staying in an Airbnb in Fort Worth area. We are waiting for our house to close. Well, technically sell. It just was listed on Wednesday. And then we will be placing an offer on a home here in Fort Worth area.
Sounds a little silly. I think most people who are listening to this will know the answer. But why Texas?
Well, you know, I need to go to a place where I feel I am me, and I felt that with what has happened in the community that I lived in, that's not me anymore. It's not safe for me and my family, and it was time to go.
So this brings me to kind of the latest development in all of this, because while you've moved, you have not let go of the issue pertaining to your termination. So you and a handful of other former Eastside firefighters have filed, I believe it's official, a series of claims totaling $170 million. What are you alleging in asking for that money?
So those are tort claim damages. It's an administrative procedure that needs to be done prior to litigation being filed. The total of the $171 million actually covers all 10 of us, not one individual. And it is discrimination based off of age, sex, and religion. And so those damages were assessed for future earnings, income, benefits, some mental anguish, defamation of character, those types of things. So both non-economic and economic damages.
Let me break some of that down. Age, sex, and religion. Are you saying you were discriminated based on your age and your sex, or just religion?
All three. So Fire Chief Jeff Clark said that he would save $1.08 million by separating 15 was the assumption number that he, when he presented it to the board in September, and that he would save $1.08 million separating 15 experienced firefighters and bringing in 15 new firefighters. He would save that money. Unfortunately, he's not saving that money when he's averaging about $460,000 a month in overtime just due to the staffing cuts.
What does your gender have to do with it?
So he did accommodate some individuals, a total of three, two females and one male, that were accommodated into a light duty status from October to approximately, one of them was April. Another one got vaccinated around December, I believe.
Is the thought there that they just wanted to keep diversity in their ranks?
I can't make an assumption, but based off the information, I would say that was probably the reasoning behind it.
Well, because I don't want to assume, but you don't look white to me.
I am Hispanic.
Okay, you're diversity. You count for diversity then.
I am also a disabled veteran.
Okay, so if the idea was to keep diversity, then they could have given you some sort of light duty status, right?
Correct.
What is the goal here, I guess, with the tort claim? As you said, tort claims are a precursor to a lawsuit. What do you hope that this $170 million ask does?
Well, as we've explained to the board of directors over the last several months, that all the meetings we've attended, is none of us want to seek litigation. None of us want tort damages. It's not about the money. We all want to return to work, and we can do it safely. You know, as we've seen in the past, and as you mentioned, even with Dr. Ray's study, we can work safely. The accommodations that a majority of us asked was testing every day that we work, which we were doing prior to the vaccines coming out, wearing the N95 mask, wearing the PPE, the goggles, gown, gloves, all that, you know, anytime we were involved in patient healthcare. And there was no attempt at even trying to continue that path. We can work safely. Let us. And no, they're not allowing us. There's not even a conversation about it. And that's what we're trying to ask the board is, hey, have this conversation with the fire chief and say, see if there's a way. You know, other counties in Washington State have brought back their unvaccinated firefighters, and they are working in patient-facing positions. Why cannot King County? Why so unique about King County?
You tell me that your goal is to get your job back, not necessarily the money, but something tells me you don't believe that that's going to happen because you're in Texas. You sold your house. You're looking for a new job. So you can't tell me you believe that you're going to get your job back.
I am very hopeful I get my job back. And if he offers me my job today, I will still live in Texas and I will work for Eastside Fire and Rescue.
How will you do that?
A lot of commuting, a lot of flying. We actually do have other members that do live in other states.
So you will, if they were to say, okay, we'll give you your job back. You're going to keep a residence in Texas, but you'll come back to work.
Absolutely. I want to work for Eastside Fire and Rescue.
How is your family doing through all this? Just the loss of a job, the stress of kind of not knowing for 7 months, picking up and moving across the country.
It's been very challenging, very stressful, a lot of tears, you know, a lot of unknowns, a lot of fears. And, you know, again, our faith is what's pushing us through. You know, I mean, right now, I will admit, no job, no home. We're truly taking a leap of faith, but I know ultimately that we're going to be very successful. And, you know, again, this isn't where I want to work. But if it's the only place I can work, then I have to be here.
To have served your country in the Marines, to have gone on to serve your community as a firefighter, something, you know, both of those things that the majority of the population would never sign up to do, and to lose your job in this way, how are you doing?
It's a hard question to answer. You know, it has been very stressful. A lot more gray hairs, you know, balding a lot more. But again, it's you know, the challenge is being taking that one step forward. You know, I have to continue. I know ultimately that I will be rewarded because God has told me that. In whatever fashion that may be. I'm really hoping it's returning to work because that's all I really want. I want to continue serving the community of Eastside Fire and Rescue, you know, and hopefully that will happen. But if not, you know, we'll have to pursue the other avenues. And I really don't, and I can speak for the other 10, we don't want to pursue litigation, not at all.
Did you guys see the fist bump heard around the world? I'll explain it to you using what I think is a very rare spot-on tweet from CNN. The news organization wrote, a little less than 3 years after promising to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state over the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Biden arrived for meetings with Saudi leadership, sharing a fist bump with the man accused of ordering Khashoggi's murder. In case you're not familiar, Jamal Khashoggi was a Washington Post journalist who was definitely murdered by the Saudi government. And so President Biden had made some strong statements several years ago about the fact that he would make Saudi Arabia a pariah for what they did.
President Trump has not punished senior Saudi leaders. Would you?
Yes. And I said it at the time. Khashoggi was, in fact, murdered and dismembered, and I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. There's very little social redeeming value in the present government.
So it's no surprise that Biden's little fist bump and his generally kind demeanor to the Saudi prince was met with anger from both the right and the left. Rep. Ilhan Omar wrote, Saudi Arabia regularly imprisons, tortures, and kills advocates for human rights and political reform in their own country, especially women's rights advocates. We should be holding human rights abusers accountable, not meeting with them. There was an op-ed done in the Washington Post, of course, where Jamal Khashoggi used to work, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant in its simplicity. And it talked about how Biden, I mean, it's obviously sarcasm, how he stood up to a bully with just a picture there of Biden's fist. This was done by their graphics columnist, and it was just sort of a picture by picture show of how Biden walks up to the Saudi crown prince and deals with him directly with just a little fist bump there. Now, I was, however, troubled by the fact that not everyone was skeptical of Biden's treatment of the Saudi crown prince. There are just some people for whom politics is the priority above all else. It doesn't matter how bad something is. It doesn't matter the optics of it. Politics will always be the priority. Max Boot did a op-ed in the Washington Post, and that's what makes this particularly egregious. And his op-ed was titled, Cut Biden Some Slack. U.S. presidents have to deal with dictators. Again, this is an opinion piece that ran in the Washington Post, the publication that Jamal Khashoggi worked for when he was murdered. I don't care if someone has that opinion. It's a terrible opinion, and the Washington Post should never have published it. I do want to also point out that the fiance of Jamal Khashoggi, the woman who was engaged to him when he was murdered, criticized Biden for the fist bump. Here's what Biden had to say about that criticism.
Sir, two quick questions, if I may. First, we just heard from Jamal Khashoggi's wife, who said, after this visit, the blood of MBS's next victim is on your hands. What do you say to Mrs. Khashoggi?
I'm sorry she feels that way. I was straightforward back then. I was straightforward today. This is a meeting, not, I didn't come here to meet with the Crown Prince. I came here to meet with the GCC and nine nations to deal with the security and the needs of the free world, and particularly the United States.
Well, yes, it is true that the president of the United States has to deal with dictators, has to sometimes meet with dictators. That doesn't mean that they have to be friendly. And it doesn't mean that they have to forget and forgive all the things that that dictatorship has done, including the murder of an American journalist. What Biden did made America look weak, and it made Saudi Arabia look strong. And that should bother every single person in this country, regardless of political or party affiliation. That's it for this episode of Undivided. Thank you for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. Remember to get those ballots in. And also, on Wednesday's subscriber-only episode, I will have in-depth interviews with two of the Republican candidates trying to unseat a Democratic congresswoman in a Washington state swing district that is going to be a bellwether for what will happen in this country. So make sure to tune in for that. If you have not become a subscriber already, please do so at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. By supporting independent journalism, you're helping in this effort to give common sense a comeback. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.